It works. Yep. Hello. Well, I hope that I'm not going to end up with stage fright because the place is a little overpowering. Not used to it. Normally, I talk to school children, and I think you're a year or two above that. My name is Tommy Comolay, and I really appreciate being invited to talk about my experiences, basically about 1944. Perhaps it will be useful if I give a little background both about myself and about where I come from, and that will create the context, which is a little bit unusual, talking about the Holocaust. I'm not talking about what most people on that topic expect to hear. First of all, let me just say how I come to be in Britain. I live in this region. I'm a one-time Hungarian refugee. And looking around, maybe half of you are familiar with the circumstances when I left Hungary, and the other half most probably not. And you will excuse me if I'm jumping backward and forward a little bit in time. Hungary, at the end of the last war, was liberated by the Soviet army. And as a consequence, the regime that eventually emerged there was a communist regime. And whereas the general principles of socialism and communism is not something that I, and for that matter, a lot of other people in Hungary would take issue with, there were lots of things that was going wrong at the time. And eventually, 10 years into the regime, a lot of people felt very dissatisfied. And as it happens, and happened since many times, it was the young who were really upset about it. And eventually there were student demonstrations and the like. And the situation ended in an uprising in 1956, which was put down fairly brutally by both the Hungarian and the Russian forces. As a consequence, some 200,000 Hungarians managed to leave the country, which up till then, if you're familiar with the old phrase of the Iron Curtain, so we lived on the other side, and not only were we not permitted to leave, we had no passports, but the borders were actually protected, so to speak, with minefields. But for a few weeks, these have been removed, and I managed to get out. And I was treated very well. I was given food, clothing, etc., which is even more remarkable when I read the news, I think only about 5 or 6 days ago, that there is in the United Nations there is a new agreement on how to treat refugees. And I was astonished to hear that apart from the United States, which wanted to be outside of that agreement, Hungary was the only country which denied participation. And considering how we were treated in my days, I found that quite shocking. And I have a few more things to say about Hungary as of today. So when I was in Austria after that escape, and not only was I physically looked after, but through a foundation which was set up for students, I managed to get a grant to come to study in Britain. I went to Glasgow, I studied engineering, I went further on to Birmingham and London, got a higher qualification, and eventually ended up working for an international company for about 37 years. Now, to come to my Jewish and family history, I'll give you a little background there as well. I was born in 36, and I had just about 1 year. Just a minute. I managed to go for about a year to a Jewish school, which was stopped later on. And after the war, because of the communist system, again, I managed to get some minimal Jewish upbringing because the communist system also put an end to that kind of education. And because my father perished in the war, I ended up growing up virtually without religion. And only when, in 1966, I met a young lady in London and we decided to get married, I discovered that she came from a religious Jewish family from Leeds. And when we first had children, the question came up how to educate them. And I fairly quickly concluded that what I could bring to the moral upbringing to these children was not anything as substantial as my wife's background. So I decided that I had to start learning about my own religion. And I'm now in the strange and lucky situation that having grown up almost totally in a secular fashion, I'm now, if you call myself a head of a family, I've got 2 daughters and 7 grandchildren, so we are now a family of 10 kosher people. Life brings strange things about. So that is my background, and I will talk about the events surrounding what happened to me. I will talk for maybe 40 minutes or so, and you will have plenty of opportunity to ask questions if you want to know more, and I'm sure that you will have interest in different aspects from what I find that schoolchildren are interested in. Let me just show a little bit. Well, this is just a general background. It's from the Holocaust Memorial Museum in Budapest. It's a list of victims. We only have 172,000 odd names there, because obviously if you haven't got relatives who survived and put your name forward, then your name wouldn't be there. And I know my family's name is up there, but I couldn't get near enough there somewhere up at the top, so I can't show you that. Let me just give you a tiny bit of explanation, geographical and political, about Hungary. As most of you will know, Central Europe has been a hotbed of anti-Semitism, but Hungary has a special role to play here. Looking at Europe, you can see it's quite a substantial country about 600 years ago. And later on it joins with Austria to become the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And by the time we come to the First World War, the country decides to side with the Germans, which is important from the point of view that, of course, they lose the war. And in those days, post-war settlements always end up with borders shifting. And Hungary, as you can see here, loses a vast proportion of its territory to the neighboring countries, mostly to the Czechs, Romanians, Yugoslavia. And that feeds the nationalist chauvinistic elements who want revenge. So when we come to 38-39, Hungary yet again decides to side with the German-Italian axis. And when the Germans decide to, well, after the Austrian annexation, they go and occupy Czechoslovakia and Poland, Hungary begins to gain back territory. However, in the remaining in the territories of Slovakia in particular and Poland, where the German troops come in, the Jewish population by this time are aware of what is happening to Jews in Germany, and they don't want to have really the same fate. So there is a vast influx of Jews into Hungary, so much so that the Hungarian Jewish population, which was about 250,000 before the war, swells to about 1 million. And some of you may have come across the phrase of the 7th million. That is what the reference is to. And when these people come into the country, there are some efforts by the Hungarian, various parts of the Hungarian Jewish community to try to look after them, and there is quite a substantial help extended to them. My uncle, who at that time was the head of the Hungarian Zionist Federation, was one of the people who tried to make sure that these people get looked after. And the other point I'd like to make, it's in a political point. If you look what eventually becomes known at the location of the various concentration camps and extermination camps, you will see that they're in Germany and Poland. And when it comes to the population of those countries and also of the Hungarian Jewry, they can only be taken to these places by rail. And there is a rather sad chapter here about the role of the Allies, because when the international Jewish community begins to realize what is happening in Europe and that it really is serious, they ask their own governments and the Allied commanders to bomb the railway lines, because that they see is the only way of stopping a massacre. And there is not much listening. They later request that they bomb the camps, the extermination camps. And what they say is 10 or 20,000 of us might get killed, but it's better that we can limit the losses once we managed to put the machinery out of action. But the military commanders say that there are much more important strategic targets, and we can't really deal with your request. So that is the general background. One other point I'd like to make, and I always make this point to the schools where I speak, but there is no harm mentioning it here, in particular with a view to the last few weeks of happening in Britain. I don't have to explain to you about Holocaust deniers, because I'm sure you're aware of all of that. Many of you would have seen the film Denial about Deborah Lipstadt and the court case. But the sad fact is that apart from David Irving, who got taken to court by Lipstadt, and who, not in this country but in Austria, actually got jailed for Holocaust denial, there are many other people around. And I just wanted to show you something. This is on the internet. You can read for yourself what they have done. You can see what they've done in using computer technology to mess around with Auschwitz. But the reason I'm showing it, you can see I highlighted in red the date, March of 2018 that somebody is still playing around with these things. So we have something to say in the matter, and obviously I will encourage anybody and everybody to do so. I actually listened to Deborah Lipstadt talking to the Holocaust Educational Trust only a couple of weeks ago, and she made one very important point amongst many, which may be useful for you if you ever come across anything like this. She said, post-war, there have been innumerable prosecutions, of war criminals. And many of those war criminals would try to get off lightly, and they would say things like, it's a mistaken identity, I wasn't really in that sector. Or they would say it was my boss who was responsible, or excuses of that sort. Not one of the criminals who had a lot to lose ever said that it did not take place. So if you come across Holocaust denials, you will know what to say. Right. I was lucky enough not to have ended up in the camps, and you will find out what my story was. And clearly, I don't want to talk to you about things secondhand. I'm going to tell you about my own experiences, because it adds to what you already know. And as you probably know, there are many people who have been actually to the camps or went through similar sad experiences who will simply not talk about it, and this is why I volunteered to talk. And although my experiences weren't as dramatic, I still have some deep memories which took some time to digest and get to the point where I will tell people about it. Perhaps the most lasting effect, as far as I'm concerned, is the fact that not only until I married my wife, but for a good 10 years after, I would never admit to anybody that I was Jewish. It was something that had better be kept in the background. It could only lead to bad things, directly or indirectly. So I pretended that I was just an average citizen. And I think now, of course, I'm in a different situation. And even so, when I hear about the present goings on, I'm beginning to wonder if a time may be coming in England where people will have similar feelings, perhaps. One interesting thing that I'll say about, I already mentioned Central Europe. Some of you may know that there are two or three countries like Serbia, Bulgaria, Albania, which behave differently towards the Jewish population. And I mentioned that not so long ago to a historian. And he said to me, that's not surprising. That part of Europe has for approaching 500 years been occupied by the Ottomans, the Muslims. And they have always had a more welcoming attitude to other religions, not just to Jews, but also to Christians. And we know about Spain, of course. Maimonides lived in a Muslim country at the time. And when I come across the current climate and the terrorist events, etc., I often take issue with people who start talking about Muslim attitudes. It isn't as simple as that. And I think it's useful to remember that we have had in the past Muslim friends, and it's really people we should be considering and not nations or races or anything. That's a personal opinion on my part. How things developed in Hungary, however, were different. Coming perhaps from this centuries-old anti-Semitism, and some of you may, some may not know, that the last blood libel trial in Europe was in Hungary in 1880 or thereabouts. Ultimately, the person accused has actually managed to get off with some help. But nonetheless, that was typical of the attitudes in the country. And the reason for it, strangely enough, arose out of the Jewish attitudes to education. It's same as here, same as in many other countries. Many of the Jewish population felt that the way to get to a better life, to advance, to succeed in life, was through education. And in Hungary, they have been extremely successful. So much so that although the representation in Hungary of Jews, the proportion of Jews in Hungary is only about 6 to 7%. In some parts, in some areas of life, and I'm talking about very broad ranges, science, education, trade, commerce, medicine, art, culture, the proportion sometimes went as high as 20, 30, 50%. And this generated an extreme reaction, jealousy, and all the rest of it. And the government in 1939 decided to reinforce earlier attempts to constrain or reduce the Jewish participation in higher education. So they bring out a law which they called numerus clausus. You can see the word at the top of the poster there. Hungary loves communicating with its people through posters. You will see it later. And they're saying, we are fighting for the better future of our country. Let's get the foreigners' influence reduced. And when by 1942, even so, this refers to the to a reduction of 2% from the average figure of 6 to 7, which is already hard. But by 1942, they decide this is not sufficient. And they want total exclusion, in other words, zero. And that includes the trades as well as education. As a consequence, 200,000 Jews lose their livelihood. And that's only the beginning. My father ran a small business of scrap metals. He has to hand it over to his foreman. I still have a little letter, a pro forma letter, where he hands it over for peanuts. I had an uncle who wanted to study architecture. He had to go to Vienna, and when he qualified there, he came back to Hungary and couldn't get a job. So in the end, he decided, he went to Switzerland. From there on to the Middle East, strangely enough, he got a job in the British Army, and when they were pushed back by the Germans, he went with them and ended in Kenya. He thought it was hard luck. He didn't realize how lucky he really was. And by 1943, the German army is beginning to suffer serious losses on the Russian front in particular. And the Hungarian army, who is supporting them, decides that they want to get assistance, get rid of the worst physical aspect of being in the war, namely the digging of trenches and construction of all sorts. And they call up all Jewish men between the ages of 18 and 60. This includes my father at the time when I'm 7 years old. And with one exception, that's the last time I saw him, really. And you can see the conditions in which they're working. And these are probably pictures taken by their commanding officer, which they sent home like holiday pictures. And there's a lot of hardship, obviously. By March of that year, the Hungarian government, which is moderately right-wing and, of course, on Hitler's side, begins to look around. They can see the Allied resistance. They can see the losses in Russia. And they put out feelers to conclude a separate treaty with Britain and America to change sides, in effect. Hitler finds out about it, and he sends German troops into Hungary. And along with the German troops come 200 Gestapo men headed by Eichmann. And one of the things that they do is they change the government to a more right-wing, more extreme government, which in turn starts looking at Jewish property. I read a book somewhere where it's a by-the-way comment where they reckon that something like $80 million worth of Jewish property is taken by the Hungarian population. And you can see how, if you spread it out among the population, people have a genuine interest in the confiscations. And we, on top of losing the business, we have lost our house and much else. And I think I lost one. Oh, no, here we go. You can see artwork piled up on the streets, artwork piled up in a synagogue. And some of you might recognize from your knowledge of Yiddish or similar Slav languages the word for Jew in Hungarian. It becomes a word which appears more and more often. And it's probably contributed to my feeling about not wanting to be one of those. You can imagine when as a 7-year-old kid, you walk around the street and this is projected all around you. I'll show you some more pictures of that. And the other thing that they introduce almost at the same time is the compulsory wearing of the yellow star, which is from the age 6 upwards. And you can see a bunch of old men being lined up for whatever purpose. There's a wedding on the right-hand side, the bride and groom displaying the yellow stars, but people still wanted to celebrate. And the little boy at the bottom is someone who turned out to be my best friend later on. He gave me that picture. And the other severe act, which matters a lot for most of us, is that in the middle of the confiscation, they also take away telephones and radios because they want to make sure that we have as little communication as possible. And at that time, there are Hungarian language broadcasts both by the BBC and the Voice of America. And some people are brave enough, despite all the threats, to hide radios, and I still remember later on in the year when we huddled around the odd radio as we were in the cellars, protecting ourselves from the air raids, and we were desperately listening to hear how far the Allies have advanced. And the other thing that happens at that time, they limit the possibility of using public transport. We can only get on in the trams, only travel in the last carriage. And there is rationing, just like there was in England during the war, but Jews get smaller rations than everybody else. And between April and July of 1944, they round up virtually the entire provincial Jewish population of Hungary, and there's a rate of transportation to primarily to Auschwitz-Birkenau of about 12,000 people a day. It's worth mentioning again the attitude, the psychology, the feeling of disbelief amongst the Jewish population on account of the contribution that we have made to Hungary. People quite simply say, it can't happen here. We are a valued, appreciated part of the community. They will not be, surely they won't be doing it. And people are denying what they should be seeing. And it's extremely difficult for the leadership to do anything to help people who don't want to help themselves. And I can tell you, or show you rather, as this is pictures from the rounding up of the provinces. I mean, you can see children, small kids, and you can see the conditions. Not only, I mean, I said to you, transportation was in railways, but we weren't talking about, of course, second, third class compartments. We're talking not only about cattle wagons, which on the bottom left you can see an open wagon. It's a 2 or 3 day journey to Auschwitz. You can imagine there's no food, very little water, very little in the way of toilet facilities, if any. And it's terrible. And people, I made a reference to the disbelief. You can see that when people are called up, and the story accompanying the rounding up is that you're being taken to work camps, and people still pack their suitcases and they take their most precious belongings and some clothing. They hope that there's some kind of a new life awaiting them. And so there is an almost complete denial, despite the fact that you only have to look around yourself to see that there is something much more vicious happening. This poster you see here is about shopping, and it's a two-way constraint. They want to stop the Christians to use Jewish shops, and they don't want to permit Jews to use other people's shops. The man here is pointing at an entrance of an open-air swimming bath where it says Jews are not allowed to come in here, like you were contagious or something. And then the other manifestation of this shopping constraint is the top picture says it's Jews are undesirable in here. The other one addressed to positively, negatively at the Christian population. Be ashamed of yourself. You've been purchasing from a Jew. Or this is a Christian shop. You're okay. You can come in here. The top left poster. I haven't mentioned this organization before. The Arrow Cross, which is the equivalent. This is a Hungarian Nazi party, which unfortunately has a some kind of a fresh awakening in Hungary today. They are just talking about you being a traitor if you use a Jewish shop, and in fact the right-hand poster is equating the communist symbol of the hammer and sickle with the Star of David, saying that if you support one or the other, you're equally a traitor. And of course, the natural development of all of this is the bottom graffiti, which quite simply says, beat up the Jews. And the symbol you see there is the arrow cross, which is the symbol of the Arrow Cross Party. The next development, we're coming to the summer of, I'll come back to that in a minute, the summer of 44, where they put out an announcement that the government have marked up, selected a number of apartment buildings in Budapest, because by now most of the provincial population has disappeared, and they're coming for the other 500,000. And Jews are only allowed 5 square meters of living space. 5 square meters is probably as much as you see your screen there. So my mother and I are allowed 10 between us. And fortunately, we have an aunt and her mother who have a one-bedroom apartment. And by moving in with them, at least we don't have to share with strangers. So we move there. And each of these houses, like you can see in the two photos, have to display the yellow star again. And the quarters, you can see every one of those little yellow dots on the map of Budapest is one of these houses. And they are marked up saying, this is a Jewish quarter now. It's forbidden for non-Jews to enter. And if you live in one of these houses, because they also introduce a curfew, and initially you can go out between 11 and 5, later on that is reduced to about two or three hours. If you don't have a doctor or a dentist in your very building and you have an emergency, then of course you have to go without medical assistance. You're not allowed visitors. If you've got a street-facing window, you're not allowed to talk through the window to anybody. And while being there, my mother tries to support us because we have no other income. From the meager rations that we have, she decides to start baking little biscuits and cakes and the like, and sell it to other people. But you can imagine the effort of going, managing in 2 or 3 hours the distribution and all the rest of it. And one of the worst aspects, I normally only say part of this to kids here, in every one of these houses, they nominate somebody or install somebody as a janitor, the concierge. And his job is to report on the movements in the house. And when miraculously my father gets a 3-day permit from his commanding officer to come home and see us, this guy gets very worried, the janitor that is, about his own position, that somebody's in the house that should be reported. He's Jewish, by the way. And he goes, runs around the corner and reports my father to the Arrow Cross. And within minutes, 2 armed men come around, take him away, and that's the last time we saw him. A lot of people, I'm sorry to say, by now begin to realize the seriousness of the situation, and they commit suicide. What I haven't mentioned so far is, I talked about the disbelief of the Jewish population of what's going on. What I haven't mentioned is that the Arrow Cross, most people know that there's a regular police in the country. There's also the gendarmes, which mostly are the provincial armed police. But the Arrow Cross, in the decade running up to this period, has been gathering such support that it's very difficult to get accurate estimates. But by now, there's somewhere between 500 and 900,000 members of this union. This is in a country with a population of 9 million people. And the Jewish population, which by now is down to 500,000. So if you are thinking of, never mind resisting, but even running away or hiding away from what's going on around you, you have got very, very low chances. I mean, these are overwhelming odds. If you even think of being loaded into the cattle wagons, as long as you obey orders and go where they tell you to go, and you may have some ideas that it is not going to be a holiday, the alternative of not following the instructions, not following the orders, is to be brutalized. And that's for sure. And if they kill you, that's for sure. So, whereas in Slovakia and Poland, there's been resistance. You all know about the Warsaw Ghetto. Well, first of all, when the uprising took place there, by then they had taken away all the older people and most of the women. The people who actually organized the uprising were the young. And they also had contact with the Polish resistance, the partisans, who in fact drew in turn from the Polish army, which was anti-German, same in Slovakia. Hungary was pro-German. So if you thought of hiding somewhere in a village, in no time at all you would have been handed over. And that, talking about Budapest, an urban population is not exactly minded to go into the forests anyway, never mind picking up guns. Somebody in a Zionist organization which was on the margin of, on the possibly thinking of resistance, actually did a stock taking, and they had something like 50 guns and 10 hand grenades and something ridiculous like that. So the only way there was any possibility of organizing anything to help rescuing people, to help survival, was by underhand methods, bribing, cheating, and all the rest of it. So some few hundred young Zionists set up printing presses. They, in Hungary, everybody had an identity card, and which carried your religion. And they would manage to erase religion, erase Jewish and put in whatever other religion. Or there were some friendly, well, that's not necessarily friendly, but neutral embassies still operational in Budapest. And they would hand out blank passports. And then these youngsters in turn would produce false passports, and some large number of hundreds or a small number of thousands actually managed to escape through that. Also, up to a point, the Hungarian government were willing to let Jews who had an entry permit to Palestine, as it then was, leave the country through Romania. And again, the the youth managed to fabricate falsified versions of these Palestine permits. So that's really as far as we got. And by this time, the Normandy landings have taken place. The Red Army is also advancing. We're now talking about help being within hundreds of kilometers. And the Allies, the Americans and the British, also start bombing Budapest. And whenever the Americans are coming during the day, the British are bombing during the night. And every time we hear the air raid sirens, we go to there's a very extensive cellars, and we have mattresses. Each family has a small allocation of space. We have keep water and bread and a couple of blankets down there. And that's where we do our listening to the news as well. And so we get to the point where we hear the bombs falling. And that is a kind of concrete memory of mine. I learned to very proudly to differentiate between the noises the various aeroplanes make. And also, I listen to the conversations. And it's a very, very strange atmosphere where you know that the people who are up there and dropping the bombs are really the only route to salvation. If they win, in other words, the Germans lose, we might be okay. But if that bomb falls where you are, you're not so okay. And yet most people call the people up there our friends. I just wanted to show you this for a moment. Only a couple of weeks ago, I saw a film about the British Bomber Command. And they were talking about the Lancasters. And when I heard the noise that they're making, I said, I recognize it. It's a strange memory. And I was very glad to see that although for decades they've been denied commemoration, at last they raised a memorial for them. What I wanted to show you here, you can see the symbol of the arrow cross on the arms of the people. And if you take away the guns and you look at the faces and the clothing and all that, you will say it's quite a nice bunch of people. They're probably in a demonstration. And you ask yourself the question, what turned them into the beasts that they have become? I mean, these are the same people who took literally tens of thousands of Jews to the River Danube because they were afraid that there was not enough time to put them on the trains, made them strip naked, and then shot them so that they would be carried away in the river. And one other, I'm just swinging between the various aspects of this time, a bit disorganized, but there was one other route to temporary escape or chances of survival. Those foreign embassies I mentioned to you, the Swedes, the Swiss, and the Spanish in particular, some people wanted to help us. Some of you may have heard the name Raoul Wallenberg, Swedish diplomat. There was also a Swiss guy called Karl Lutz, and there were others who made these passports I referred to earlier available. And also what they did, they bought up some property around town and they put the emblem of their country on the entrances because for some strange reason there was still a kind of legality kicking around whereby they would say if this is diplomatic property we mustn't enter there. So if you managed to get a place in one of these buildings, then you were temporarily okay. And through my uncle that I mentioned to you, he was in touch with the Spanish embassy and the Swedish embassy, who we managed to get into one of these a small scale four bedroom villa in the suburbs, where there were about 40 of us. You can imagine the living conditions: 40 people with one kitchen and one bathroom, that kind of thing. And just mentioning with reference to my uncle, again, through he was also accepted by the International Red Cross as their representative, and using them and the Swedish Swiss embassy, he managed to set up some orphanages where he recruited some 500 or 600 helpers, and at the last count they managed to save something like 6,000 orphan children to the end of the war. And one more very personal and very significant event I want to mention to you. My mother was continuing from this protected house to look after us with the baking. And one day she went out delivering. By this time, I'll come back to that in a second. And she was in the middle of delivering. She told me after the war, not at the time. She was caught by the Arrow Cross, and they started marching her to one of these collection places. And I mean, these pictures you see here, obviously, are not about her, but when I saw them, I just said, I recognize the story. And she was saying to herself, by now, she knew for sure that the end of that road is something that you don't want to face, and it's probably a definite deportation equal death in most people's mind. But she wasn't so much concerned about herself. She was concerned about me, because she knew that I would be left with those strangers in the house, no relatives, nobody to look after me, so I would probably perish. So although they were guarded by four armed Nazis, she decided to make a run for it. And as she was running, they started firing. They missed. And as you would under those circumstances, she turned around to see what was going on, what to do next, which way to go. And to her utter amazement, she saw she was the only one who attempted this. In the confusion, in the firing, probably 100, 150 of those people could have run away. But by this time, they were all so demoralized that not one of them tried to follow her example. And that's how, unfortunately, thousands and tens of thousands perished. So, as the winter came in, the government by now was taken over by the Arrow Cross, and they set up a ghetto about 1 square mile in the middle of Budapest. And you can see there fenced in. And you can see it even in German. These are dangerous animals in there, or worse to that effect. And my mother, who obviously had a great deal of foresight, said to herself, that so-called safe house isn't going to save forever. And through some miracle, she managed to contact her father, who discovered a Christian family who said they would be willing to hide us. So late December, she said to me one evening, we're going out of here. I'm taking off the yellow stars. And if anybody stops us, don't even think of anybody being Jewish. We are just one of the many families, and leave the talking to me. And she packed a little case for herself and gave me a little backpack. And we got on the tram, and miraculously nobody stopped us. We got to this family, and they put us in their cellar. And very luckily, they lived on the eastern edge of town. So as the Russian advance continued, we were virtually the first area of Budapest that got liberated. And you can see there was the street-to-street fighting in Budapest, and the Russians came in. And as the Germans were retreating, they blew up all the bridges across the river. So when we waited and waited to get the news what was happening, we were on the Buda side. Probably many of you know we got two halves of town, Buda and Pest. And my mother was very anxious to find out what happened to the rest of the family, and waited a couple of weeks. Eventually, she said, let's go. We picked up our belongings, got to the riverside. And of course, there was no way of getting across, other than you can see on the bottom left, if you got sharp eyes, some enterprising people set up a ferry service in their leisure boats. And for, I don't know, Jews or whatever you could use for bartering, they would take you across. And we went across and met my grandmother, who told us the sad story as far as she was aware. That's me with the arrow sitting on my father's shoulder. Or that's my mother's family, otherwise, of whom six survived. And of my father's siblings, of the six, only two survived. And what followed in the next few weeks, just to conclude the story, my mother was desperately looking for my father. We could fill in a form like this to the Red Cross if you wanted to find somebody. The other picture, that's my uncle with a... If you go to the Central Synagogue in Budapest, you will see that commemorative plaque there. And we used to go every day, every other day, to the Central Synagogue, where a kind of ritual developed. It was mostly women who would put up little notices on the railing and on the walls saying, I'm looking for so-and-so, my husband, my son, my father, who disappeared. And very infrequently, somebody who by now, people started coming back from the labor camps or from some of the concentration camps, and they may put up a response saying, I've seen your father in a hospital, be hopeful he might come back. But more often than not, it didn't happen, of course. And in terms of the administrative situation in Hungary by this time, the Russians put in a civilian government, which tried to restore democracy. They put in fresh laws restoring Jewish rights, and notionally we were entitled to get back everything that we lost. We didn't get back the business. We got back, I think, five or six pieces of furniture. The rest, courtesy of our neighbors, all disappeared. And there were a few trials of the main perpetrators. I think two or three ministers got executed. Some thousands got jailed for limited terms, but it was very far from justice being served. The successive governments that came into power didn't see fit. You can see the arrow marking that plaque, which is on the side, on the riverside, not until 2005, 60 years after the event. They put in a commemorative sculpture. If you go to Budapest today, you will see it in the tourist guide. it is just referred to as the shoes. And this is representing what's been left behind of the people who were killed into the river. And the other memorial is for the forced labor units. And there is also, this is just back in the Holocaust Institute, and these are memorials raised by the Jewish community to those two people I mentioned to you, Raoul Wallenberg and Karl Lutz. And what I really want to conclude with is, I said at the beginning, there were only 200 SS in Hungary. Everything else was carried out by Hungarians. And when you read the news, I don't know how many of you read the Jewish Chronicle, not this week, last week. Colin Schindler had an article about the Polish Prime Minister having been there and the Hungarian Prime Minister then would follow, now he did. And they're being kind of liberated from their consciences. As far as those guys are concerned, it was all the Germans. Hungary got a grant from the European Union to raise a Holocaust memorial. They put up a pathetic, horrifying sculpture which shows the symbol of the Germans, an eagle, coming and attacking a saint which is supposed to represent Hungary. And this is the Holocaust memorial. Germans attacking Hungarians. And for several months there was a vigil outside of this memorial in the center of town. People would bring photos and other memorials of their lost relatives. And this was going on 24/7. And today there is still a remnant of this. I can tell you, and it's a long story, if somebody wants to know about it, I can tell you. I've actually come to reconcile myself with what the Germans did. For one simple reason, because they have actually owned up, not only owned up to their deeds or deeds of their forebears, but also they put in an education system where they're teaching their children about history, about what happened, what shouldn't have happened, and accepting the responsibility. And I met a lot of Germans my age and a lot younger who have been seriously, positively affected by that. I find it extremely difficult to go to Hungary because of what I just said to you and also what's going on inside the country now. There's a hugely right-wing and I would say anti-Semitic government in power, and it's getting worse by the day, and there's no effort whatsoever to accept any responsibility. And there was a Spanish-American philosopher called George Santayana who said, those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it, and that's exactly what I'm really concerned about. So I'll finish there, and there's a lot more I could say, but I think it would be more useful if I handed it over to you, and if you have any questions, I'll be very pleased to answer them.
Before you said that, you said, look at the Arab hospital. They look like normal people, and you asked why would they do such a thing? You didn't get around to answering it.
Well, it's not a question that I can answer. I really can't. Other than saying, if you haven't heard the question, I posed the question, why would people do the beastly things that they did, and I haven't answered the question. I can talk about jealousy and greed, and some more basic instincts. I don't know. I'm not a psychologist or whatever it would be.
you seem to hint a little that this country is not, we're not as safe as we think we are. Last week, I think the offices shut down the Jewish school. Are you suggesting that we need to be a lot more concerned about this sort of thing in this country?
We're talking about personal opinions, so I didn't mean to say that we're unsafe in this country. In fact, to the contrary, up here last week, whenever I heard people in private conversation talk about anti-Semitism in Britain, I would say, you don't know what you're talking about. You haven't lived in a country where there is proper anti-Semitism. With what's going on in one of our serious parties at the moment, what we call a moderate party, I hope it's nothing like what has been going on in Hungary, and I hope it's not even like what's going on in France. I have a very high opinion of Britain. I wouldn't like to live anywhere else. And it's appropriate to consider what's next. Now, that's a personal opinion.
Thank you very much, Tommy, for your words, and also we have to thank the Holocaust Educational Trust who facilitated Tommy speaking here today. Thank you.